Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight. We're sort of wrapping up the year, and at late notice we thought it'd be good to put Jocelyn Chale in the program, and so here she is. I'll introduce her briefly. She's well known to some of you, I guess. Graduated at the University of Sydney, worked with the Department of Trade, the Department of Foreign Affairs, and then of course the Department of Trade became and Foreign Affairs became the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade. Had two postings in Beijing, as I understand it. She speaks both Mandarin and Cantonese. Her last posting was as Consul General in Hong Kong between Australian Consul General in Hong Kong between 1992 and 1995. Of course, she's also published articles on China. Over the last 10 years, she's been a visiting professor at the University of Sydney in Chinese Studies. And tonight she's going to talk on the topic of China's soft power and the Confucius Institute. Now, I think we're all set up. If anyone has any trouble hearing, let us know, but I think everything's right. So, Jocelyn, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you, thank you very much, Gerard. Pleasure to be here. And I must apologise before I begin because I'm going to give you literally a one-eyed talk. I've only got one eye that's working at the moment. This means that I may wander a bit because I can't read my paper to you. I've just got some notes and I will speak to them. But if I get too far off the track, please call me back into order. I might say that, you know, I think it's very good to have an opportunity to talk about China in this week when almost the only thing that people are thinking about in Australia is the elections. And there's been absolutely no mention about China in the lead up to the elections. I guess the last thing we heard about it was that Kevin Rudd could speak Mandarin and Alexander Downer could speak French. And from the on TV the other few days said, well, I can't speak Mandarin, but I've eaten a few. I can say I do speak Mandarin, and I have eaten some, and maybe I've even been one. most of this talk is going to be about Chinese foreign policy. And then at the end, I will say a little bit about the Confucius Institutes, but that's not really the main focus. So I want to, before I get around to talking about the Institutes, I'd like to put into context. And the context, of course, is what we all know about, and that is the growing economic power of China these days. And that has led to it playing a much greater role in international affairs, and it has a new ability to win friends and influence people it never had before. So China is much more active, and it's more confident, it's more assertive, and Chinese diplomats are much more skilled also than they were even 10 years ago. So dialogue with China is changing because of China's growing economic power. And at the same time, the expectations of dialogue partners are growing. Increasingly, countries like Australia are calling on Beijing to use its influence to help solve problems such as threats from North Korea or the oppression in Myanmar or genocide in Sudan. So you might say that the management of relations with China, both in bilateral and also multilateral contexts, has never been more important than it is at the moment. However, we must also note at the beginning that China is a one-party state and the Communist Party has no intention of giving up that power. On the contrary, we can see a lot of evidence that they are in fact stiffening their ideological control for instance, in the lead up to the Olympic Games, they are increasing their regulation of the internet and banning the discussion of certain subjects like the 1989 Tiananmen massacre or the activities of the Falun Gong. And the latest evidence that I have is that the Lonely Planet Guide to China has been banned. If you were thinking of going to China, you won't be able to get it in unless you hide it, because its map shows Taiwan in a different colour from the mainland. And this, of course, shows that the editors support independence for Taiwan. So in foreign relations, the effect of this one-party control of international relations is that diplomats have very little flexibility in enforcing decisions or interpreting instructions, and their performance is measured in terms of how well they have met the set targets from the party. This was put very well by Chris Patten, the former governor of Hong Kong. Speaking about his negotiations with representatives of Beijing, he said, "The Chinese system meant that negotiators would have no room to question their instructions, would not always know what the overall strategy behind the negotiations was, would only have one order, and that was to attack, to surrender no ground, and to come back with a clear-cut victory." Now, in the terms of foreign policy, under President Hu Jintao, China has a very unique set of principles which are known in a short as peaceful rising. And this is an amalgam of both strategies and tactics which reflects China's historic and cultural experience. But it also incorporates current international thinking of what is known as soft power. That's a concept that was developed by Joseph Nye. And Nye defines soft power as the ability to persuade through culture, value, and ideas, as opposed to hard power, which depends on military might. And he gives us a classic example of soft power, the French government's global campaign to resist the onslaught of English by teaching and defending the use of French through the network of the Alliance Française. Another example, which he doesn't mention, might be, for instance, the Fulbright program, which the American Senate established in 1946 with the aim of increasing mutual understanding through the exchange of persons, knowledge, and skills. Nye wrote in 2003-2004, and he noted that China was then a growing economic power, but it seemed inexperienced in the use of soft power. And about that time, I wrote a review of Australia-China cultural relations over the 30 years since the establishment of diplomatic relations. And my comments, looking back now, I see were very much along the same lines as Joseph Nye. So critical of the extent to which China had learned to use soft power. These comments did not go unnoticed in Beijing, and for various reasons. First of all, these comments accord with Chinese traditional policy regarding the conduct of international relations. That's principles that were established back in the 1950s by former Premier Zhou Enlai, and chief amongst those is the principle of non-interference in internal affairs. That means avoidance of military power or strong-arm tactics. And that principle has been maintained pretty steadily by China. In practice, Chinese prefer to use a softly approach. Secondly, in 2003-2004, soft power diplomacy offered possible solutions to some of China's most difficult international relationships. I use international from our perspective because I would include first amongst those relations with Taiwan and secondly with Southeast Asian neighbors. Now, of course, cultural diplomacy is not new, although it was not well developed at that time. You may recall the years of panda diplomacy or ping-pong diplomacy, which would characterize the period up to the 1980s. They were rather crude tools, however, and that they've been considerably refined in recent years. Combined with the economic and trade incentives, the Chinese Communist Party has learned to use propaganda tools both domestically and abroad to shape public opinion and to implement government policy. and I would say they have been remarkably effective. We might look, for instance, at polls that the Lowy Institute carried out, which shows that the perception of China as a threat to peace and security has declined progressively in recent years, at the same time as, by comparison, attitudes to the United States have changed and no longer seen so positively. This change has been called by Joshua Kolancic, China's charm offensive. And it's interesting to note that Kevin Rudd presented George Bush with two books when he, George Bush was here in Sydney, and one of them was Kolancic's book about Chinese foreign policy, which is called Charm Offensive, How China's Soft Power is Transforming the World. And Kolancic notes that the change in public opinion of China is most marked in Southeast Asia, and he says that that is where the charm offensive was first put to the test. Now, the background to that, of course, is that ASEAN-China relations have got some problems inherited from history. The regional economies feared China's growing economic might. They could see, for instance, the textile industry was migrating to China from places like Taiwan and Malaysia. And they also feared historically the role that the overseas Chinese had played in Southeast Asia. And therefore, they were much more amenable to an approach which talked about peaceful rising, that is, that China was not going to be a threat to either to them, either economically or military. That policy has been successful in turning around perceptions of Chinese activities. So a little bit more detail about Chinese foreign policy objectives. The most recent formulation, which coincides with the recent Communist Party Congress in China, is summarized by a commentator from the China Foundation for International Strategic Studies, Mr. Zhang Tuosheng, who lists four hallmarks. One, equal priority of domestic and foreign affairs, and he defines domestic affairs as achieving a well-off society by 2020 and developing a framework for reunification with Taiwan. Two, advocacy of a new security outlook. Three, the development of bilateral relations with foreign partners. And four, and here I quote, playing an active part in international affairs with emphasis on gaining soft strength and acting as a responsible big country. Now, of course, Beijing regards Taiwan as an internal matter. That's why he doesn't list it as a foreign policy objective. But as he explains, it does interact with international relations. If we were to reformulate those four then from an Australian perspective, we might say that number one objective of Chinese foreign policy is to establish the government in Beijing as the rightful government not only of the whole of the mainland but also of Taiwan. And a second key objective is what Zhang calls being a big country, which is alternatively usually translated as a great power in the world. That is often formulated in China as regaining the rightful place internationally. And party and government theoreticians believe that that should evolve naturally rather than by military or direct intervention. Now, one unstated factor in all of this is the role of the overseas Chinese community. And that dates back to the Manchu government, which formulated a nationality law in 1909 and that claimed that ethnic Chinese anywhere in the world were citizens of China. And that in turn led to the development of a political structure of the nationalist government in Taiwan, which included representatives of overseas Chinese. It was only sometime in the 1950s that the Communist Party in China actually abandoned that position. But the relationship between Beijing and overseas Chinese communities continues to be an important one and more complex, particularly as large numbers of Chinese are leaving China either to live permanently or temporarily over abroad. So Chinese government now recognizes that people who are citizens of other countries owe their primary loyalty to that country, but the complexities leave many grey areas, and it's very evident that Chinese overseas missions give quite a high priority to monitoring the activities of local ethnic Chinese communities. As far as China's economic policies are concerned, well, you know, China is now a country which calls itself socialist with Chinese characteristics, sometimes formulated as market socialism. This means, as they have developed their freed up their domestic economy, that they have the party has lost a lot of the control measures that they used to have when it was a planned economy. And replacing that, the party now relies a lot more on engendering a spirit of nationalism, or pride, or patriotism, and that applies not only to Chinese in China, but also to work amongst overseas Chinese communities. And we can expect that that trend will continue and in fact become more pronounced in the lead up to the Olympic Games. To some extent, that kind of nationalist approach is linked with a Confucian belief that China is the center of the world civilization, and also incorporates a belief that ethnic Chinese are somehow superior to other groups, both inside China and also overseas. And that perhaps has got a historic context, because it was a Han Chinese movement to overthrow the Manchus that was linked with the patriotic revolutionary movement that led to the formation of the Chinese Communist Party. But I should note that this is not something that's exclusive to the communists. When the nationalist government moved to Taiwan in the 1950s, it began a campaign to bring back Chinese values and Chinese culture in the local population, which it believed had been too much influenced by years of occupation by Japan. So this kind of ethnic pride movement in China, I would use that term rather than chauvinism, is relevant to China's international relations, and it's particularly relevant to reunification with Taiwan. It leads to the view that Chinese who live overseas somehow lose some of their Chineseness. For instance, the party has promoted the view that the former Taiwanese leader, Li Donghui, he was the president from up until 2000, was too much influenced by his education in Japan. That is, he was not 100% Chinese, and therefore he was not patriotic. And the same view has been expressed about some Hong Kong Chinese, that they've been affected by 150 years of British rule and education in English, and so they've lost their Chineseness, and that leads to inappropriate and unpatriotic demands for democratic rights. So, for instance, Emily Lau, who is an American-educated founder of the pro-democracy party, The Frontier in Hong Kong, has been called a traitor to China because of her comments that the people of Taiwan should decide the future of Taiwan. The corollary of this kind of propaganda line is that if Taiwanese and Hong Kong citizens and overseas Chinese in general were re-educated in Chinese language, if they understood the officially promoted versions of Chinese history, and if they participated in patriotic events, then of course they would be more patriotic. And mainland publications frequently imply that it's better to rely on Chinese people rather than relying on foreigners in order to wipe out the shame of 100 years of exploitation by foreigners and to regain China's rightful place as a great power. That word comes in again. So that China will never again be humiliated. So this is the encapsulating what the Communist Party is trying to do while it's maintaining a one-party government. And it has evolved a kind of tactical approach to the imposition of measures that might restrict economic development. So that is to influence public opinion overseas so that America will not regard China too much as a threat and not regulate that Chinese trade and exports. And the soft power approach is also endorsed by Chinese defense force leaders. Their objective is to secure wide support from overseas Chinese in particular, and from the international community, and then from business leaders and opinion leaders, that they in turn influence the development of foreign policy, particularly in the United States, to be favorable to Beijing. And this approach, this soft power approach, is applied to all kinds of countries, but particularly to those where there is a large Chinese, ethnic Chinese community, and those which have got a lot of natural resources that China needs, and those that have close ties with Washington. And Australia is seen as falling into all those three categories. Now, what about the Confucius Institutes? In the 2003-2004, the Communist Party developed a plan to set up Confucius Institutes around the world. Why Confucius? It's interesting that only just 30 years ago, Mao Zedong and the Communist Party said that Confucius was a symbol of feudalism and everything that was wrong with Chinese society. To some extent, the reason they were attacking Confucius then was because he was espoused by the Nationalist Party in Taiwan, and the Nationalists had kept up traditional Confucian ceremonies as part of their claim to be the legitimate government of China. So to revive interest in Confucius in the mainland is also partly intended to be a tactic to win over dissident elements amongst the Taiwanese and the overseas Chinese. And China is in fact quite keen on Confucianism at the moment. And I could give you some examples, but we don't have much time for that. Now, just to quote you one commentator, writing in the Hong Kong Da Gong Bao, which is a left-wing newspaper, and a commentator called Tang Yu, writing about Confucianism, says, "Outstanding historical culture, including historical individuals, is the soft power of a country. And this type of power has an ability that far exceeds the power of the economy or the military. And Confucianism is to be promoted because it stands for cohesion, affinity, and vitality." That clearly, those sort of concepts apply to the goal of reunification with Taiwan. However, that's just the name. What in fact are these Confucius Institutes? Well, they are a program which is administered by the National Office for Teaching Chinese as a Foreign Language, which is commonly known as Hanban, and linked to the Chinese Ministry of Education. It is in fact governed by representatives, not only that ministry, but several other government departments, and it's chaired by a state councillor, which is an indication of the importance that's attached to its soft power activities. You can find out a lot about the Confucius Institutes if you look at the Hanban website. And according to a report in May last year, the Chinese Ministry of Education planned to set up 100 Confucius Institutes around the world to teach Chinese language and culture. In fact, they've already exceeded that target. The first institute was set up in Tashkent in 2004, and the latest was set up in November this year at Rutgers University in New Jersey. There are various figures for the total number of institutes. According to that very reliable source, Wikipedia, there are currently 106, I counted them this morning. Outside the United States, which has 28, the next largest numbers are in Thailand and South Korea. And it's interesting that both those countries recently have very strong trade ties with China. Anyway, you can find out a lot of information about the Confucius Institutes if you look at various Chinese embassy websites. Each one is slightly different, and according to a conversation I had with our education counselor in the Australian Embassy in Beijing in August this year, the Hanban is still sort of developing its ideas about how to administer the global program. Now, clearly the movement is inspired to some extent by the Alliance Française, which Joseph Nye listed as the classic example of soft power. But there are some differences. And the main difference is the degree of control that the government exercises over the administration and the operations. There's an author at Christchurch University in New Zealand has written in a book which is just about to be published on Communist Party propaganda, Confucius Institutes are the Chinese equivalent of the Goethe Institute or the Alliance Française, the British Council. They focus on popular outreach rather than scholarly research. Unlike equivalent organizations, they are strategically located in various foreign universities, allowing Chinese authorities to have an element of control over the study of China and Chinese language at these Western universities that they would not normally have. Now, let me make it clear that the additional resources that the institutes bring to the teaching of Chinese, I think, are very welcome. Certainly, our economic and political future is going to be bound up more and more with China, and it's very important that we engage more with the history and culture of that country and other Asian countries. We have indeed a long history of research and teaching of Chinese language and history, and so we shouldn't suppose that the Confucian Institutes are coming into a cultural void. There are already lots of classes in Chinese language in Sydney. For instance, at the WEA, various community colleges, the Friendship Society, and extension programs at several universities. So the Institute is in fact going to compete in the same field as those. What they're going to offer that's different is that there will be a Chinese government-backed teaching program, and teachers will be seconded from China. We have to ask the question whether they are going to be open to everyone. If, for instance, you were a supporter of a cause like independence for Taiwan, full democracy for Hong Kong, human rights in China, religious freedom, including the freedom to belong to the Falun Gong movement, free Tibet, or Uyghur independence, or would you be welcome to attend these classes? I don't know the answer. The location of the institutes in host universities is a default model, as I mentioned. The program does provide for institutes to be set up and run directly by the Handan, but there aren't many examples of that. Now, why would they want to do it in a university? And one reason is so that they'll benefit from the prestige name of the university, the backing, and this will help them in that competitive market environment. Another reason is clearly budgetary. The global programs of the Alliance Française and so on are expensive, but this institute program based in local host organizations, the costs borne by the Chinese government are minimized. And it's Tim Wright, who is a board member of the Confucius Institute at Sheffield University, has noted in a recent article in The Guardian, that the institutes are going to need ongoing subsidies from China if they're going to be viable over the longer term. In Australia, the activities are mainly community-based language classes and executive training and cultural events. The first institute was established at the University of Western Australia in 2005. Followed by others at the University of Adelaide and Melbourne University. And the University of Sydney has signed an agreement in principle to set up the fourth institute. And Deputy Vice Chancellor John Hearn has noted that the worldwide objectives of the institute include not only the promotion of Chinese language and culture, but also the promotion of the philosophy of Confucianism, which would mean that the Sydney University Institute would be slightly different. Now, the main focus in all of these four is extension, teaching, and community liaison. And clearly, in that regard, they can contribute a great deal to the development of friendship and understanding and the enlargement of bilateral relations. However, this year, and looking at the global program, a new dimension is emerging, which might be seen as a logical extension of China's foreign policy objectives. And that is that they are becoming more involved in what you might call regular mainstream activities on campuses. So, for instance, University College Dublin offers Chinese language courses through the Institute to students at that university, as well as to the wider community. In April this year, Waseda University in Japan, which already had a cooperative research program with the University of Peking, signed an agreement to establish an institute that the Chinese government announced was the first research-based Confucius Institute. Now, with this in this area, I think it becomes more problematic for universities, because when you have in setting up an institution which would have clear direction and backing from a foreign government, then you have need to put in place very strict controls about how you're going to preserve academic freedom. However, these are early days, and we have to wait and see just how these institutes develop. As I say, the history of them being set up in Australia is still very new, and it's hard at this stage to evaluate just how they're going to work. What I have found out about the institutes in Europe, which in particularly in Germany predate those set up in Australia, is that there are not so much problems with the content, of course, academic content of courses, but with practical things like getting the right people, you know, inviting somebody to teach language and they get somebody to teach classical philosophy instead, they're not turning up at the right sort of time, they don't have the right sort of visa, the taxation provisions for their employment are not clear, and so on and so forth. These are just practical issues. Scholars around the world already researching Chinese economic and political and social development. And generally, my colleagues at the University of Sydney and elsewhere are producing some excellent, fair and unbiased work on China, and that has been very well publicised. I would say, taking the liberty of speaking for those colleagues, that we welcome the Confucius Institute program insofar as it supports culture and outreach. If in the future it were to become engaged in academic research or teaching in Chinese studies departments, then we would want to make sure that the work was very closely delineated, and we want to avoid a situation where research was biased in any way towards any goals that were stated by the Chinese Communist Party.
Thanks, Josh. Remarkable achievement with one eye. So I say congratulations to you and to your eye surgeon. So many thanks for that. We've got till no later than 7 o'clock, so we've got plenty of time. Can you just fill me in with just a bit of detail? You spoke about 4 Confucius Institutes in Australia, Western Australia, Melbourne, Sydney, and one other,
Adelaide.
And so how much money are we talking about, do you know, for each or all? You just speak to the end of the room.
I know I there was an article in Sunday Age about Confucius Institutes, and particularly focusing on Melbourne, and Tom Hyland said that he'd asked the Confucius Institute for details about their budget, and they had not divulged it. But we know from what's been written about British Confucius Institutes that the Chinese government has contributed the equivalent of $100,000 over 3 years for setting up those.
Yes, just this afternoon on Radio National, I heard that he'd been an academic in China saying that he felt that the development, the deliberate development of Confucianism by the government, the communist government, was actually aimed to prevent the development of the expansion of capitalism into liberal ideas, into democracy, and that they had hoped that if the Confucian philosophy was encouraged in China, they would manage to retain communism plus and capitalism. Confucianism without leading to democracy or liberal values and freedom and so on.
Well, that was interesting. I'd like to I'll look that up and see if I which program on.
Counterpoint.
Excellent program. Yes. Well, there's been, I didn't hear that talk, so I can't comment, but there is a great deal of debate about the role of Confucianism, with people in China coming from very different perspectives. And it's been quite widely reported in the scholarly press. And there have been some foreign academics also participating in that discussion. So that is certainly one point of view, but it's by no means an agreed point of view on the role of Confucianism at the moment.
So, yeah. And now, Justin, can I just announce her, but can you just talk to the end of the room? Okay. And so you get behind the microphone.
Yes.
Pretend you're giving a speech. Yes. And?
$100,000 is not an awful lot of money.
No.
So what is the university contributing? Because I can't imagine academics, couldn't have any academics living off that for very long. I mean, that's not a lot. What's the money going to, and who else is contributing?
Well, that doesn't in fact include, in addition to that, they're going to provide textbooks and teaching materials. Textbooks and teaching materials, sorry. And also sending staff from the partner university in China. So I think two staff. Apart from that, you know, the ongoing costs of the administration and the premises and so on will have to be paid for by the host institution.
So who pays the salaries?
The Chinese institution, the university which is sending the two staff.
Okay, so they don't have to pay the salaries.
I don't know the details, but I can't see that a Chinese academic salary is going to go very far in Sydney. And when you put to, you know, our labour regulations or work choices, I'm not quite sure what kind of visas they will be given or what. I don't know.
$100,000 US doesn't sound.
Yeah, $100,000 US was what happened in one university in Britain.
Yeah, but you know, it doesn't pay for much.
I know, but it's one university.
In Britain, it's even less.
We don't actually know what's happening here. We just don't know. I think that's right.
Yeah.
We don't know now.
There must be money coming some other way.
But it may be
the universities are putting it up, which is excellent, as long as they don't take it out of the budget for it's already there.
Good
point. So here is Robin.
Thank you very much, Jonathan. Could I ask a question and then, two questions, one question perhaps, one question, kind of comment.
I'd like to have a speech as well. Two questions are better than a speech and a question. One question is better than both.
First question. You mentioned to me that the Chinese government was concerned that only the education had caused the Taiwanese government to become a Chinese, etc., etc. In that context, how come that they see such an advantage in sending so many Chinese students overseas where they pick up these nasty ideas about democracy, freedom, religion, and all those other things that came back? And second, that's the question of what their overall viewpoint about the advantages and disadvantages that is. And secondly, in the context of censorship, particularly in the lead up to the Beijing Games, I got back 2 weeks in China to Hong Kong on Saturday, and about 11 days ago, CNN backed out, as I understand it does quite regularly, just backed out for a short period, and then the following morning, I tried accessing sma.com.au and australia.com.au, etc., and they were backed out. So I wondered what was going on that I was not supposed to know about. And the South China was post hard copy section then, and what it was, of course, was the story with Yahoo. Senior executive apologising for the incarceration for 10 years of someone who sent emails about democracy, etc. Do you have any comment on the general aspects of that?
Well, the first question was about the Chinese program sending students overseas. And that's quite a specific program as far as government initiated overseas study, and it's usually at postgraduate level. So I think it's much more problematic for China, and they're not at all keen on children coming up for schooling and then followed by university study. And there's been some things written in the Chinese press about the practical problems of that, and it is hard for high school students to get visas to come and study there. I mean, it's not impossible. So the Chinese would prefer people to come when they're already established in their own professions and in their careers. That doesn't always work that way. And of course, there are a lot more people now who are far more people who are coming overseas as private students than as government-sponsored students. And that they're a very important part of the student population of all the universities in Sydney and elsewhere in Australia. The Chinese Students Association on the campuses is generally the largest and most active of any of the student associations. It appears to be very well funded and to have close links with the consulate. And I imagine that one of its functions is to try and keep in touch with all the mainland students who are studying on in the university. That's probably as much as I can say about that first question. About Yahoo, well, what more can be said? I mean, you've just outlined the facts, and it was another example. I wanted to give that as an... quoted the banning of the Lonely Planet guide, because that's a simple story. The Yahoo story is more complicated, and I don't know all the ins and outs of it, but certainly it is another case of that tightening of party control over foreign media and information.
Jin.
Okay.
Not too long, Jin.
Pretty long.
No, I've tried to
tear the page in half. One of the really Chinese elements of the Chinese culture, the Chinese Communist Party has been long been a vandalizer and the destroyer of Chinese culture. So now they set up a Confucius College across the world in the guise of protector or advocate of Chinese culture. So this, it's a genuine motive, it's questionable, and worth of a suspicion. So my concern is that is Australia economic quite clearly aware of it, or how Australia will defend this kind of a cultural encroachment or ideological invasion, which is the genuine aim of the Chinese government. Thank you.
A nice statement. As I said, our dialogue with China has really changed with China's growing economic power. For instance, in the human rights dialogue, we used to be much more sort of hard line, but recently we tend to take a much softer approach to what China is doing, admitting that they're much bigger than we are, and you pick on somebody your own size, or you pick on Burma in places that are other than China. I think it's going to also affect how we deal with China on things like the Confucius Institute. It's not impossible to maintain an equal relationship with somebody who is bigger and more powerful than you are, but you need to go into it perhaps having read Sun Tzu on the Art of War and knowing how to defeat an enemy from an inferior position rather than a superior position. And I think all that can be said about academics and the institutes of being associated with campuses is that people should have their eyes open and know what they're letting themselves in for and keep monitoring the situation carefully.
question here.
If I'm correct in assuming that Confucianism is a philosophy based on, well, it's a non-political philosophy based on ethics and morality, if that's the case, then I have to also assume that the Chinese politicians select parts of the philosophy that suits them. They may even add certain principles or rules that are not really a part of Confucianism. And take, for instance, the Yahoo situation. Surely the dobbing in, or forcing the Americans to dob in the bloggers for, you know, to control the Chinese bloggers in China is really non-Confucianism. Am I correct?
Well, yes.
What if Confucian take a block?
Well, I don't think the Confucius Institute has got anything to do with Confucius any more than the Goethe Institute have anything to do with Goethe.
Then it's a misnomer.
There's a question here.
It's a misnomer.
My wife and I recently had a very interesting trip to China, including 3 days in Tibet, and my not very deep knowledge of China is that up until probably the end of the 18th century, China was a feudal society and the emperor was all-powerful with lots of helpers. I just wonder, in fact, whether democracy would ever really work in China, the size that China is. You know, whether, in fact, if China went from being the sort of country that it is at the moment to a more democratic society, whether we'd have thousands of little political parties and whether the whole country would fall back into chaos.
Well, that's a whole new topic, really. There's a good book just came out last week, I think, John Lee of the Center for Independent Studies, called Will China Fail? Which he deals with the tension between growing economic power and whether that can continue without having an equal growth in the democratic system. And there are a number of people who have written on that topic, you know, suggesting that maybe China could become a kind of federal system or something like that. I don't think there's time to discuss that tonight. But I'll just take you up on one point, and that's about the 18th century and Tibet. Because, in fact, you know, the major acquisition of territory in Xinjiang and Tibet, which dates from the 18th century, and before that, these places were, while we might say they're in the Chinese cultural orbit, for instance, the whole province, which is called Xinjiang, the new borders, they were established only in the 18th century. So Chinese control, that kind of imperial control that we're talking about, doesn't go back in that part of China any longer than that.
There's a question there and then at the back here. Yes.
I'm slightly off the topic, but are you able to explain why the Chinese government is so bothered by the Falun Gong?
Well, it is relevant, I think, because the Falun Gong, I think what really alarmed the Communist Party was the speed with which they were able to gather people for a massive demonstration in Beijing through internet, fax, communication that was not monitored and controlled by the party. These people just appeared and took the party by surprise at the size of that demonstration. That plus the fact that they are well funded, that their leader of Falun Gong is based outside China in the United States. So it's a power structure which exists outside anything that is within the control of the party. And other organizations in China all have to have kind of at least a registration with the party and some kind of affiliation with the government, and the Falun Gong doesn't have that. So it's not so much what they believe in, what they practice, as their structure.
This question right down the back here.
We have observed that China uses nationalism, culture, soft power, as we also included all that, philanthropic actions in Africa, lots of African countries. What do the rest of the world do? Do they react? Can they see the warning signs of a potential future imperialist there from China, as it has happened before with Germany, with US, with all the imperialistic powers of the past?
Well, I think we just have to get used to the fact that China is determined to be a great power, and it is going to be much more active and much more visible in the international arena. The hope, I think, of the Australian government and other governments is that by becoming more active internationally, China will learn to play by the rules, that they will modify, for instance, their human rights records. Now, that's, I think, still a big question. I'm not sure that that's been borne out, say, over the last 10 years or so, that China has been increasing its visible activities internationally. So, but it's a question for the rest of the world, just as it's a question for Australia, how to come to terms with it.
The question about China and democracy always comes up. You know, they can't manage it because they're Chinese, and yet Chinese people outside of China are very good Democrats, and many Chinese people inside China who would be very good Democrats. India manages a very large population, almost as big as China, and they're a democracy. What is it about China? Is it just propaganda? Is it because the system of has been for so long discouraging of disintegration or multipolar kind of society? What is it about China that creates this sort of argument?
Well, Taiwan manages to combine
big. They use the argument big.
What's democracy with Chinese culture? So I don't think there's anything intrinsic in Chinese culture that goes against democracy. If you were to look deep into the heart of Confucian tradition, you might say that it puts far more emphasis on sage government, that is, you know, government must be by good people rather than by elected people. But that doesn't go against democracy. It may explain why there hasn't been so much a demand for democracy, because the belief, I think, that many Chinese people have that, you know, if you have good people in governments, that's a big plus. But I think as people's income levels rise, everywhere in the world they start to demand more say in how their money, particularly their taxes, are spent. So there will certainly be greater demands for democratic rights in China.
The second last question down the back there. Yeah. Yes.
You mentioned the change in the Australian relationship with China in terms of human rights. Given China's increase in economic strength over time. And I was just wondering whether you have any comments about the commercial aspect to that relationship. For example, you hear about China's unhappy about BHP, and also about coal prices in the sale contract negotiation.
That's a tough question.
What is it?
We just missed the question. The question was, what about China's commercial influence in negotiations between BHP and Rio Tinto? China was opposing the BHP proposed takeover, or in commercial contracts for the sale of gas or oil, gas, for example. But I think it's probably a bit beyond your topic.
It would take us certainly over the time available. But I would only point out that just as Chinese Ministry of Foreign Affairs is becoming more skilled in the use of soft power tools, so they are also becoming, I can see, more skilled in their understanding of international market. And so, for instance, they are now making strategic investments in overseas companies, but they are not doing it by, let us say, in the case of steel, by Chinese steel companies investing in overseas steel companies, but China Development Bank and other development banks buying into overseas corporations, which will then buy into the steel. So they're obviously becoming much more sophisticated in their understanding of how international economics and international markets work.
Can you take a quick question there? It's going to be quick, yeah?
Another question on Australia-China relations. Is there a change of government next week? Do you suspect there'll be any significant changes in our relations with China? Would
no.
The current government sincere and maybe more willing to, you know, to confront China on some of the more
difficult issues? No, I think the only difference is that Kevin Rudd knows all about China. So. Or he thinks he does.
Just a final question. Been very informative talk, but how new is this problem? I mean, as you know, if you went back 30 years ago, if you wanted to get a visa, go in and study in China, you sort of had to form in a certain way, because otherwise you'd lose your visa if you want to go into Eastern Europe. If you were too anti-communist, you wouldn't get into Eastern Europe. A lot of people, like Lee Campbell, who still appears regularly on Philip Adams, according to reports in the Sunday Telegraph, used to take state-sponsored holidays in Stalinist East Germany, per courtesy of Stalinist in East Germany. I mean, there was a lot of that going on. So, and a lot of that was hidden. Manny Clark took a trip to the Soviet Union. Frank Hardy lived off royalties from the Soviet Union. So to what extent, I mean, we know about the Confucian Institute, but I mean, is it a more serious problem than what happened when we didn't know about it in the past, both with respect to Eastern Europe and China?
I think that the blacklist system doesn't apply, generally speaking. And you know, anybody who's been in China recently will tell you that generally the intellectual climate there is much freer than it has been. I've had very free and frank discussions with Chinese people, but all off the record. Right? It's only when you come to that intersection of public order, of the security forces and so on, that things get tricky. And I'm sure that, you know, the staff who come to work on the Confucius Institute here will be relaxed and informal, and will be happy to have discussions on all sorts of topics with their colleagues here. But it's when you come to certain forbidden topics, like I listed, like Taiwan and Tibet and so on, that you'll start to feel the hot breath of the Communist Party.
Many thanks. Many thanks to the gentleman Chair for a very informative and a very balanced and reasonable assessment about Chinese soft power and about in general and about the Confucian Institutes in particular. So thanks for coming along tonight. Now the full paper, which you cut back tonight, but the full paper Anne will publish in the Sydney papers along with your footnotes, which we don't usually do, but special favourable footnotes. Just as Michael Kirby has the record, I think it's 14,000.
You mean 70 and 80.
70 and 80, you're in the 50, so that's
Michael
Kirby. So that just shows you how much we respect your...
It's only 41.
So once again, Justin Chen, many thanks for a great performance tonight. Thank you.
Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.